this is a major statement. Thompson has done it again, and let's go into it. Okay.
All participants are now muted.
He was writing essays for Wild River Review. You can look it up, wildriverreview.com. And under Thompson, you will see all these essays. He's contributed a lot of stuff. So this book is called Beyond Religion. And the subtitle is The Cultural Evolution of the Sense of the Sacred. The Cultural Evolution of the Sense of the Sacred. And it says, from shamanism to religion to post-religious spirituality. From shamanism to religion to post-religious spirituality. The sense of the sacred. So the cultural evolution. Cultural means media grounds, McLuhan-esque, so to speak, though he adds other aspects, not just limited to McLuhan. The cultural evolution of the sense of the sacred from shamanism to religion to post-religious spirituality. And there are six items. Well, actually seven. There's a preface by Joy Stock, who is the editor of this website, runs the show, and I think I know who she is. She used to be at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City in the 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, when Carol and I would go to his lectures. He'd show up for a month or two each year, sometimes twice a year. Thompson would, so I remember her, Joy Stock. So she does a preface. Then Thompson does a foreword called Thinking Otherwise on Religion. He quotes the famous Irish guy, Bishop Berkeley, who is a key figure at the end of Finnegan's Wake. Bishop Berkeley, a famous guy, he's the one who, I think he's sort of like he believes in the hyper-subjectivity. Everybody makes up their own realities. So he says, we Irish think otherwise. Some sentence like that. That's the famous Bishop Berkeley statement. So Thompson, being Irish, says, thinking otherwise, or being like Bishop Berkeley, on religion. So part one is child abuse in the Catholic Church, and Thompson was brought up a Catholic in Los Angeles, and he got semi-abused, not complete physical abuse, but he got semi-abused, so he understood what the priests were capable of. He got that when he was a teenager. And part two is from shamanism to religion, which is a good essay. Then part three is, well, actually, the foreword is part one. And chapter one would be part two, child abuse in the Catholic Church. Chapter two would be part three, from shamanism to religion. Chapter three would be part four, from religion to post-religious spirituality, part one, or section one. Then chapter four, which is part five, from religion to post-religious spirituality, section two. Then in chapter five, it's called Our Contemporary Cultural Evolution of Spirituality, subtitled Modern Integral Tantra Yoga. So there's Tantra Yoga, but Thompson puts integral in front of it, an integral or integral in front of it, and in front of that, modern. So this is chapter 5, which is the sixth part, Our Contemporary Cultural Evolution of Spirituality, Modern Integral Tantra Yoga. Now, I read chapter 6 or part 7, I don't know, last week, maybe on Saturday, Sunday morning. It was called Conclusion, The End of the Age of Religion and the Emergence of Symbiotic Consciousness. But I had not read chapter 5 until the other day, maybe yesterday. And so this is what I'm going to read, and it's pretty interesting. So, Our Contemporary Cultural Evolution of Spirituality, Modern Integral Tantra Yoga, starting on page 56 of this small booklet, only has about 90 pages. Okay. Now, he opens referring to a book by Joy Stock. She and her friend, Angie Brenner, went to Turkey, or Anatolia, and they did a book called, as a result of it a year or two ago, this is published in 2013, so by them, Anatolian Days and Nights, A Love Affair with Turkey, Land of Dervishes, Goddesses, and Saints. So he starts off referring to them. In their journey to discover the Divine Mother, a subtext through much of Anatolian Days and Nights, A Love Affair with Turkey, Land of Dervishes, Goddesses, and Saints, Joyce Salk and Angie Brenner are not simply writing anecdotal travel literature, but exploring a more profound evolution of culture that is holding out new roles for men and women. Then the first section within the essay is called First Age Great Mother. Neolithic cultures expressed a shift from shamanism to religion with a priesthood and ceremonial sites. So Neolithic cultures expressed a shift from shamanism to religion with a priesthood and ceremonial sites. So that's the religion phase, priesthood and ceremonial sites. In Kayonu, in Turkey, not far from Göbekli Tepe, T-E-P-E, there is strong evidence of infanticide as a form of human sacrifice. Since the female expresses the enduring mode of time in the eternal return of the lunar and menstrual cycle, and the male expresses the vanishing mode of time as embodied in the rise and fall of the phallus, it is probably the male that is the sacrificial victim. A sacrifice is a performance of the mystery of time. The male, either as the involuntary victim in infanticide, or murdering kids, as we see at Kayonu, that's the male in that situation, or as the voluntarily self-immolating adult aspirant. So the male as an involuntary victim in infanticide, or as a voluntarily self-immolating adult aspirant. Voluntarily self-immolating adult aspirant, or wannabe, or seeker. So the male, either as involuntary victim in infanticide, we see that at Kayonu. Then we see in the case of the patristic Christian Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N, some theologian, who Christianized the ancient practice of offering the testicles to the goddess Cybele by offering up his testicles to the new goddess Holy Mother Mary, that's the Jesus' mother. That is the what he's calling the second case of the voluntarily self-immolating adult aspirant. So this patristic Christian Origen, who Christianized the ancient practice of offering the testicles to the goddess Cybele by offering up his testicles to the new goddess Holy Mother Mary. Either case, the male is the sacrificial victim in the great goddess religion. And then there's a photo of a sculpture. It's called The Many-Papped Diana of Ephesus, as the authors point out on page 230. So Joyce Stock and Angie Brenner have a picture in their book. And it looks like an old goddess with a whole bunch of coconuts around her stomach. And people call it the many-papped or many-breasted, many-titted Diana of Ephesus. But Thompson says this figure is actually not a many-breasted goddess. Those breasts, in quotes breasts, are really the testicles of males attached to her body, representing the sacrificial offering of their sexuality by aspirants seeking to serve in the unique priesthood of the great goddess, be she called Cybele, Artemis, or Holy Mother Church. So he's saying that each one of these testicles represents some guy donated his balls to her because they really want to get their shit together. They want to get tuned into something. So that was the first stage, Great Mother. Now the second stage is the patriarchal reaction to this domination in pre-religion, so to speak, by the women, or the female shaman. In the religious iconography of the Ice Age, one can imagine how menstruation was seen as the holy mystery of the wound that healed itself. The goddess figures, like the Venus of Losel pictured above, were daubed with red ochre. Is that how you say that, Karen? Ochre? O-C-H-R-E? Ochre? Ochre. Even earlier than the red ochre daubed on the Venus of Losel is humanity's to-date first symbolic artifact from South Africa around 77,000 years ago. Then has an image and it says, note that this piece of red ochre is inscribed with the female pubic triangle, an icon that will be later inscribed on the walls of the Franco-Cantabrian Paleolithic caves and later on the walls of Neolithic settlement Catalhoyuk, C-A-T-A-L-H-U-Y-U-K, I think that's in Turkey. And then he has another image, and he says, note also the white dot in the center of the red pubic triangle, and recall how this symbolic pair survives in the red and white essences of tantric yoga's coital maithuna, M-A-I-T-H-U-N-A, and the contemporary image of the Kali Yantra. So you have these Buddhist icons. But I'll read that again. Note also the white dot in the center of the red pubic triangle, and recall how this symbolic pair survives in the red and white essences of tantric yoga's coital mithuna and the contemporary image of the Kali Yantra. I think the coital mithuna is the picture of Shiva and Shakti, the god and goddess, having sex. It seems, Carolyn, in the popular position you see on TV now a lot, where the guy lifts the woman up and puts her on a table, and then she's sort of slips down on top of his dick, and he's got to stand there, screwing away while standing. All right, that seems to be a retrieval of these Indian icons. You're not on mute. You're off mute.
I know, and I can't touch it, but I'll say this. That's where Patrick Swayze created that icon image in Roadhouse.
Roadhouse. Is that after Dancing, Dirty Dancing? Dirty Dancing was about 81.
Yeah, I don't know. Wait.
So how do you know that?
I remember it.
From way back then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. All right, so... So continuing the essay, there is evidence from ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic texts that the pharaoh Khufu, or Cheops, C-H-E-O-P-S, sent an expedition to the desert of southwestern Egypt to collect mefat, M-E-F-A-T, that's in quotes, a red mineral substance that was used to decorate the pyramids. Isn't there a pyramid quite red, Carolyn, on howionic.com? Just red in there somewhere in the background. There is also evidence that red is the first color to be linguistically encoded, and that Khoisan women, K-H-O-I-S-A-N, in Africa still use red in rituals to mark menarche. That's getting your period, right, Carolyn?
Right.
And that women were exclusively used in the mining and trade of this precious mineral substance. This ritual behavior, extending as it does over millennia of human culture history, indicates that red ochre was used as a symbol of the power of menstrual blood that was seen as a magical issue from the wound that healed itself and brought forth new life in synchronous rhythm with the moon. Menstrual blood and a symbolic associate red ochre were the first emblems of the sacred for prehistoric humanity. But in the age of Neolithic animal, now we're going to move to later, that's Paleolithic humans. Now we move to the Neolithic, starting to stop being nomadic and starting to settle. But in the age of Neolithic animal domestication and stock breeding by nomadic herdsmen, paternity could be more clearly discerned and understood. They saw it in the animals. In the rise of the Abrahamic religions, that's Hebrew, Christianity, and Islam, one observes a transvaluation of values in which menstruation becomes seen as foul. Okay? When the priest, the male priests take over, they turn this sacred process into evil. As it says in the Jewish Zohar, that's Z-O-H-A-R, quote, "For there is no defilement in the world greater than that of menstruation." For there is no defilement in the world greater than that of menstruation. So the priests did a B1 on a basic body process. Okay, the Abrahamic religions present the goddess cultures of the Middle East as evil and seek to contain and restrict the power of women. With the shift from villages to city-states, priests and warriors become the new powers, and the traditional mystery of blood in menstruation is replaced by the priests and warriors' ability to take blood, you know, in war and battle. You get that, Carol? Yes, and sacrifice. Orthodox Judaism and Islam go to extremes in the effort to devalue and control women. But Catholicism's refusal to recognize women as priests can also be seen to be part of this pattern of culture in which the male appropriates the power of the female through a Holy Mother Church composed only of celibate or eunuch male priests. That's what the Catholics do. This devaluation of women by the priesthood can also be seen in the academic priesthood of archaeologists. Archaeologists tend to dismiss any discussion of the Great Mother's symbolic complex as New Age goddess worship. So they dismiss what Thompson is looking at as the cultural history. They say that's just New Age bullshit, says the patriarchal archaeologists in universities. So the archaeologists tend to dismiss any discussion of the Great Mother's symbolic complex as New Age goddess worship and consider it to be on the level of modern witch covens or pseudo-druids at Stonehenge for the summer solstice. Pseudo-druids at Stonehenge for the summer solstice. They dismiss Marija Gimbutas, that's G-I-M-B-U-T-A-S, they dismissed Marija Gimbutas' three volumes of archaeological work and insist that there is no evidence of a great mother religion. Steve Mithin, M-I-T-H-I-N, insists that, quote, there had been no mother goddess at Göbekli, G-O-B-E-K-L-I. What Stephen Mithin overlooks is the fact that the temples themselves are often expressions of the body of the goddess. The structures at Göbekli Tepe, that's G-O-B-E-K-L-I, and then T-E-P-E, two words. The structures at Göbekli Tepe may be symbolic wombs. Consider how the shape of the goddess is expressed in the form of the temples in the following imagery. And it gives some pictures of the Göbekli Tepe, of something in Malta, of Ishtar from Nineveh, N-I-N-E-V-E-H, and the West Kennet Long Barrow. That's in Ireland or England. So we have considered how the shape of the goddess is expressed in the form of the temples in the following imagery. What we see is what we are, and often scholarship itself is disguised autobiography. In spite of its astonishingly early development of philosophy and the study of consciousness in the Upanishads, U-P-A-N-I-S-H-A-D-S, India is not above this process of the appropriation of the feminine. In medieval Tantra yoga, the woman is looked upon as a mere storage battery of prana, P-R-A-N-A. So the male is counseled to withhold his semen to use the penis to suck up the generative power of the female as a source for his yogic transfiguration. Read that again. So the male is counseled to withhold his semen to use the penis to suck up the generative power of the female as a source for his yogic transfiguration. This is the esoteric side, one that Gandhi invoked by trying to maintain his health by sleeping chastely with nubile virgins, just as King Solomon had done. The exoteric, as opposed to the secret esoteric, the mainstream side, the exoteric side of this cultural formation is seen in arranged marriages, something called sati, S-A-T-I, and strict controls of women by their fathers and brothers. We see this pattern of culture also in China, in Taoist sexual religious practices, Taoist, T-A-O-I-S-T. So we see this pattern of culture also in China in Taoist sexual religious practices, and as well in the Confucian, that's Confucius, and as well in the Confucian ethos where the woman is looked down upon, as is expressed constantly in the Confucian I Ching. So that's a quick summary of the patriarchal reaction to the great mother matristic, matriarchal societies. So we come to the third stage, modern Tantra. Americans, as products of a consumer society, think that Tantra yoga is a kind of advanced Kama Sutra, a famous popular sex manual in the 60s. So Americans, as products of a consumer society, think that Tantra yoga is a kind of advanced Kama Sutra that is simply a way of having better sex and more intense orgasms. Actually, Tantra, with its literal meaning of stretching the thread and weaving the cloth, is about the stretching of the personality formation that is precipitated by the blocking of the simple satisfaction of desire. So you block simple satisfaction of desire, that leads to the personality formation being stretched. This frustration of desire expressed in the Tantric Sutra, so he's saying, you know, people think Tantra yoga is something where you screw more, but he's talking about you don't do sex in medieval Tantra yoga. This frustration of desire expressed in the Tantric Sutra, quote, the woman you love you must not possess, precipitates the original formation of psyche in the infant's birth experience and bonding with the mother. In this original mind, one experiences both the mother as benevolent, he names two goddesses, Uma or Parvati, and malevolent and terrifying, which is Kali. So in this original mind, one experiences both the mother as benevolent and malevolent and terrifying. Sexual bondage and obsessive fascination with a dominatrix is an expression of an infantile psychic formation of the frightful mother. Sexual bondage and obsessive fascination with a dominatrix is an expression of an infantile psychic formation of the frightful mother. The experience of the intimacy of birth followed by separation and imaginary abandonment creates a split in the psyche in the male infant's experience of the primal female. On the one hand, there is the female of physical closeness in birth and nurture in nursing. And on the other, the absent female that is constructed in the imagination in a desire to bring back the missed intimacy of the mother. This role of the imagination in creativity often resurfaces in adulthood with artists and poets. When desire for the female is blocked, the artist often responds with an explosion of creativity of works dedicated to the absent beloved. John Keats had Fanny Brawne, B-R-A-W-N-E, B-R-A-W-N-E. W.B.H. had his Maud Gonne, M-A-U-D-G-O-N-N-E. Fraulein Lou Salome was an unattainable virgin for Nietzsche, but Frau Lou Andrea Salome was a surrogate mother for the adolescent and almost infantile Rilke. He was a early 20th century poet, Rilke, R-I-L-K-E. The woman the poet cannot have becomes an image of the absent part of the soul that could not incarnate, but was left behind in spiritual words. Do that again. The woman the poet cannot have becomes an image of the absent part of the soul that could not incarnate, but was left behind in the spiritual worlds. A theme I explored in my book, The Time Falling Bodies Take to Light. That came out in 1981. It's a good book. Evergreens liked it, but we heard in that section that Kim brought us, Ion mocks the book, The Time Falling Bodies Take to Light. So, he does a lot. What I'm reading, he does in detail in that book. Let's see. For the artist, the woman you cannot have takes possession of your soul. The woman you can have become partners in the humdrum routines of daily life. Can you imagine in the Liebestod of Tristan and Isolde, that must be by Wagner, can you imagine in the Liebestod of Tristan and Isolde, the two lovers singing out in their arias, quote, I'll do the dishes if you take out the trash. Those are the humdrum routines of daily life, which most women are subject to in their relationship with men. Paradoxically for the poet, the works that he hopes will impress his love and win her over seldom do. Frau Lou, the one involved with Rilke, Frau Lou Andreas. Well, there's two. There's Fraulein Lou Salome for Nietzsche, and then Frau Lou Andrea Salome for Rilke. So, what'd she say? Frau Lou, for example, preferred the sublimation of sexuality into the intellectual life with men like Nietzsche, Rilke, and Freud. So maybe this Frau Lou hung out with all three of them. The men she actually married or had sexual relations with were not geniuses, but rather conventional men of the sort she could feel more comfortable with. For a femme fatale, gliding on the waters in a regatta, the man needs to be her dense anchor that can provide her safe harbor when she wishes not to berth in a narrow dock, but drop anchor out in the harbor where she may be admired by all. Remember, Ion talked about women above all require security. So she has this suppressed sexuality but intense intellectual life with Nietzsche, Rilke, and Freud. But she does not marry them or have sexual relations with them. So Thompson says, the men she actually married or had sexual relations with were not geniuses, but rather conventional men of the sort she could feel more comfortable with. Now, she was a femme fatale. For a femme fatale, gliding on the waters in a regatta, a boat racing situation, the man needs to be her dense anchor that can provide her safe harbor when she wishes not to berth in a narrow dock, but drop anchor out in the harbor where she may be admired by all. You get that, Carol? Like, if he's going to be out there and be a tease, she has to have her husband back home. All right? So it says, La femme fatale can also often be a woman for whom physical intimacy and the loss of control and orgasm can be deeply disturbing and resisted. So the femme fatale does not want to lose control and orgasm. La femme fatale can also be a woman for whom physical intimacy and the loss of control and orgasm can be deeply disturbing and resisted. In her narcissistic love of self, the femme fatale can more maintain power over the men attracted to her through the power of intimacy, followed by refusal, so she can maintain power that way, than by a simple bestowal of her favors in which she must give rather than take. Reading that again. In her narcissistic love of self, she can more maintain power over the men attracted to her through the power of intimacy, followed by refusal. So she gives a little intimacy and then refuses them. That's how she maintains power. Then she can get more power that way than by a simple bestowal of her favors in which she must give rather than take. Allowing herself to become a screen for imaginary projections, La Femme Fatale discovers a way, in Weber's terms, he was a sociologist, discovers a way to maintain charisma and avoid routine. So that's what you're always doing, Carolyn, walking around in your medical world, being a femme fatale, withholding, you know, maintaining charisma and avoiding routine being a doctor, right?
Right.
Is that you? Dr. Dean is eating her chicken or fixing it or preparing it for some secret cooking ritual. Therefore, she cannot unmute. So the next paragraph. In some cultures with rigid class structures, the female is of one class and the wet nurse and nanny of another. This division can constellate itself later in a psychic split in which the male can only be sexually excited by women of this lower class or different race. This split can reconstitute itself as the familiar one between the virgin and the whore, the frigid white woman and the sensual black woman, the wife and the mistress, or in the case of Tantra, the immanental mode of the wife. That's immanental. Not imminent as if arriving soon, this is like pervasive. The immanental mode of the wife in Tantra and the transcendental mode of the Shakti. Tantra yoga has proven itself to be particularly attractive to the West because it holds out the archetypal image of uniting. It holds out the archetypal image of uniting the sacred and the sexual. Now he's saying that it can be attractive in Catholic and Puritanical Protestant cultures, in which the men and women are fanatically separated. So do that again. Tantra yoga has proven itself to be particularly attractive to the West because it holds out the archetypal image of uniting the sacred and the sexual in Catholic and Puritanical Protestant cultures in which they are fanatically separated. So the dream or the goal of uniting the sacred and sexual happens in cultures that already split the sacred from the sexual. As the male in tantric practice passes through the zone of infantile form psychic turbulence, he becomes ready to perceive the feminine as more positive, as Shakti and not Kali. Medieval Tantra seeks to co-opt this stage in the terms of a patriarchal culture. Modern Tantra is one in which the couple are tantric consorts to one another, but not owned by the other, as opposed to medieval Tantra. This stage, the modern Tantra, often requires a spiritual being as sponsor in what becomes an emergent triad. In Buddhist terms, this sponsor will be called a bodhisattva, a spiritual being who overlights a practicing sangha. In Judeo-Christian terms, this sponsor would be called an angel. In the medieval Jewish Kabbalistic Zohar, Z-O-H-A-R, there are discussions about how the married couple, through sexual intercourse, can invoke the feminine face of God, or the Shekinah, S-H-E-K-H-I-N-A-H. Just checking the time. Okay. So, okay, in medieval Tantra, the focus is on the etheric body as the vehicle of illumination. The system of cerebral-spinal chakras that are closely linked to the physical body and maintains its life and health. Consequently, the aspirant's mystical experiences will have a strongly marked physiological basis, such as feelings of bliss or visions of light, the elevation of Kundalini and its consequent experience of the opening of the third eye. Let's read that again. So he's saying there's a difference between modern Tantra and medieval Tantra. Consequently, well, in medieval Tantra, the focus is on the etheric body as the vehicle of illumination, the system of cerebral spinal chakras that are closely linked to the physical body and maintains its life and health. What do you think of that, Carolyn? Medicine, the cerebral spinal chakras maintaining the health of the body. Isn't that Barbara or somebody? Barbara McClintock's book. Remember that one, Barbara somebody? Had the book in New York?
Yeah.
Anyways, do you know of a practice in medicine that derives from that attitude?
Not in medicine.
Ayurveda comes from that? Okay, consequently, the aspirant or seeker's mystical experiences will have a strongly marked physiological basis, such as feelings of bliss or visions of light, the elevation of Kundalini, and its consequent experience of the opening of the third eye in quotes. Modern neuroscience would seek a strictly physiological basis for these experiences and talk about endorphins for bliss and the stimulation of the pineal gland, which is the ancient light-sensing organ associated with sensing the circadian rhythms of day and night. Cognitive science, however, is not of a single mind on these issues, and some scientists are quite reductionist and speak in terms of linear causation and brain-based triggers for these so-called mystical experiences. These scientists are, not surprisingly, often either in the employ of the big pharma corporations or have their research funded by them, by big pharma. They are in search of new mood-changing drugs and cures for manic/depressives. Other cognitive scientists, in contrast, are more independent and involved in philosophical studies as well as laboratory research, such as the scientists associated with Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and the Mind Life, that's hyphenated, and the Mind Life conferences sponsored by the Dalai Lama, and the Zen Brain Seminar organized by Joan Halifax Roshi at the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe. These scientists and philosophers speak less in reductionist terms, but more in the ideas of complex dynamical systems. Illumination, however, is not enlightenment, as the Zen and Tantric Buddhists, or the followers of Sri Aurobindo, will be the first to point out. Illumination is a strong physiologically based process, but enlightenment is an experience of higher and more subtle bodies than the etheric body with its elevation of Kundalini. One can have experiences of illumination, but still be subject to pride and expressions of spiritual cruelty or manipulation, as we saw with all the gurus and Zen masters who were involved in sexual and financial exploitation of their disciples. Whether one calls this higher spiritual experience of enlightenment, quote, the descent of the supramental, the descent of the supra, S-U-P-R-A-M-E-N-T-A-L, the descent of the supramental as Sri Aurobindo does, or, quote, the wisdom heart of universal compassion, or Rigpa, R-I-G-P-A, as the Dalai Lama does, depends upon the culture into which one has been immersed. Any serious contemplative practitioner can see that illumination energizes the body and expands the personality to the breaking point. This period is characterized by states of psychic inflation and godlike or guru pretensions that one saw expressed everywhere in the 1970s. This stage, in traditional Vedic terms, is called, quote, the boiling of butter to make ghee, unquote. Ghee is G-H-E-E. As the personality is raised to the boiling point, the ugly globules... Do that again. As the personality is raised to the boiling point, the ugly globules of white fat are to be removed to achieve the clarified golden elixir of ghee, G-H-E-E. Obviously, help is needed here to aid the aspirant in gaining an objective perspective of what is fat and what is gold. And this can be provided by a teacher or guru. But if the guru himself or herself is suffering from psychic inflation, one that is encouraged by the hierarchical structure of most monasteries and ashrams, then the whole spiritual community gets into trouble. So I'll just read that part, last part. But if the guru, so you seek them, obviously help is needed here to aid the aspirant in gaining an objective perspective of what is fat and what is gold. And this can be provided by a teacher or guru. But if the guru himself or herself is suffering from psychic inflation, and then Tom says, this psychic inflation is encouraged by the hierarchical structure of most monasteries and ashrams, that happens, then the whole spiritual community gets into trouble. In medieval tantra, the Shakti, as the female consort, is dominated by the male. But in modern tantra, the initiatic couple are compassionate consorts to one another, and are more like partners in the contemporary dance than archetypal figures in a traditional ballet's pas de deux. Pas de deux, P-A-S-D-E-D-E-U-X, that's French. So they're like partners in a contemporary dance rather than archetypal figures in a traditional ballet. What am I doing? But in modern tantra, the initiatic couple are in compassionate consorts to one another and are more like partners in a contemporary dance than archetypal figures in a traditional ballet's pas de deux. The pas de deux is old-fashioned, almost medieval. In the tantric triad, which means you've got the couple plus the guru, in the tantric triad, the choreographer for this dance is the bodhisattvic or angelic being that overlights the initiatic couple. In fact, the very definition of initiatic, in quotes, initiatic, means the presence of such a being in the practice or sadhana, S-A-D-H-A-N-A, that's the practice. The focus of this practice, in yogic terms, is not so much on pranamaya kosha, or the etheric sheath, but the higher sheaths from manomaya kosha through vijnanamaya kosha to anandamaya kosha. In the explanation of this form of contemplative practice, there will always be two opposed models, the mechanistic and the mystical. As the quantum physicist Niels Bohr, B-O-H-R, said in his explanation of the complementarity of wave and particle, quote, "The opposite of a fact is a falsehood. The opposite of one profound truth may very well be another profound truth." Read that again. "The opposite of a fact is a falsehood. The opposite of one profound truth may very well be another profound truth," unquote. So contemporary neuroscience presents a brain-based explanation of mystical states. From this reductionist point of view, what the Buddhists call enlightenment is simply the achievement of the default setting of mind when one subtracts discursive thinking and perceptual motor processing by staring at the wall through endless hours of zazen. Z-A-Z-E-N. So reading that again, from this reductionist point of view of the scientist or mechanist, what the Buddhists call enlightenment is simply the achievement of the default setting of mind when one subtracts discursive thinking and perceptual motor processing by staring at the wall through endless hours of zazen. That's partly what Ayn says about meditation. This state of awareness is not a thought, an image, or a sound, but a space-like samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I, of light that the aspirant's culture has mythologized as enlightenment. So this state of awareness is not a thought, an image, or a sound, but a space-like samadhi of light that the aspirant or seeker's culture has mythologized as enlightenment. And the perception of bodhisattvas or angels is simply the experience of the mind in a hypnagogic state of lucid dreaming. And Thompson says, "From my point of view, one that is determined by my own immersion in the culture of music, art, and poetry, these visions, experience, and meditational trance states are one of the highest forms of art. Instead of going to the theater or the opera, one experiences a personal, highly interactive art form. As an adolescent, Thompson says about himself, "As an adolescent, my mystical experience of bliss and the opening of the third eye came as an aesthetic one, as I was listening to a Beethoven string quartet. If cognitive scientists wish to explain away Bach and Beethoven or dismiss love as a matter of pheromones and neurotransmitters, then let them live on with their lives dismissed. But I shall persist in my folly with love and beauty. As William Blake said, quote, if the fool would persist in his folly, he would become wise," unquote. This new tantric triad expresses an emergent stage of culture for women and men and is a transformative vessel that differs from sacramental marriage. Marriage is the immanental mode of being, one needed to create children and the cultural continuity of tradition through the family. The new tantra expresses the transcendental mode. The new tantra expresses the transcendental mode. In vigorous yogic practice, the menstrual cycle of the woman can stop, indicating she's now giving birth not to the ovum, but to her higher self. For the man, the seminal fluids are transformed into cerebral spinal fluid, and this indicates that the yogi is generating not children, but his higher self. Neither the immanental nor the transcendental modality of self-realization is superior to the other, but they are archetypally different, and married couples do not express the same spiritual dynamic as tantric consorts. Perhaps one can appreciate this cultural process of the evolution of spirituality if one looks at tantra through the magnifying lens of Jean Gebser's Five Structures in the Evolution of Consciousness. Now, Gebser, G-E-B-S-E-R, was a European thinker. And the five structures are the archaic, the magical, the mythical, the mental, and the integral. The archaic structure of consciousness lays down the very basic formation of sexual dimorphism in the harmonization of the primates, such as the shift from olfactory to visual dominance and from estrus to menstruation. The magical phase, emphasis in history a little later, the magical phase of culture, the magical emphasizes the numinosity of the body fluids of blood and semen in ritual. In Borborite Gnostic rituals, their heretical Eucharist was an ingestion of bread with menstrual blood and semen on it, a heretic's pizza, if you will. In Indian tantric rites, there was also a mixing of red and white essences, or a left-handed path in which cultural norms were violated in ritual practices, such as having intercourse with a woman during her period, or ingesting the mixed sexual fluids of male and female in the tantric kiss. The magical and mythical phases often overlap. So we did the archaic, the magical, now he's going into the mythical. The magical and mythical often overlap, but the natural drift of the mythical phase, that would be the civilization alphabetic phase, is to shift the emphasis away from the body fluids and ritual to meditation and the sublimation in which the yab-yum, Y-A-B-Y-U-M, and a sublimation in which the yab-yum posture of ritual intercourse is seen to be symbolic and not to be taken literally, a marriage of wisdom and compassion. This symbolic shift is seen on the gloss on the Song of Songs in the Bible, in which an erotic Near Eastern marriage poem is reinterpreted to signify the marriage of Christ and the church. We've heard Ion talk about that. This symbolic shift is seen on the gloss on the Song of Songs in the Bible, in which an erotic Near Eastern marriage poem is reinterpreted to signify the marriage of Christ and his church. This process of sublimation and refinement continues in the mental structure, that's the industrial phase. This process of sublimation and refinement continues in the mental structure in which the relationship between the male and female is raised to a level without sexual expression. One familiar form of this would be the mentor and muse relationship, in which a couple does not have intercourse, but the relationship inspires intellectual growth and artistic creativity, as for example in Nietzsche's frustrating relationship with the young Lou Andreas Salome. A less tortured form of pas de deux, this is the transcendental, no, this is the, pas de deux is the more medieval one, but it's a less tortured form of pas de deux than that of virginal Lou and syphilitic Nietzsche. So a less tortured form of pas de deux than that of virginal Lou and syphilitic Nietzsche can be seen in ballet, in the mentor-slash-muse relationship between George Balanchine and Suzanne Farrell. The partnership between Dame Margot Fontaine and gay Rudolf Nureyev expressed yet another form of artistically reconstructed sexuality. They were not lovers, but their dancing was archetypally sexually dimorphic. In the case of Balanchine, the relationship was a sad love affair, but not a sexual one, since Balanchine was married, 59, and Farrell, Suzanne Farrell, was 19, and a devout Catholic for whom adultery was a mortal sin. Nevertheless, their relationship was enormously charged with longing and desire that became the creative triad of dance, choreographer, and dancer. Nevertheless, their relationship was enormously charged with longing and desire that became the creative triad of dance, choreographer, and dancer. Suzanne Farrell inspired Balanchine, and he created several ballets for her. Then Thompson has a picture of Life magazine, August 23rd, 1965, with Susan Farrell, the young ballerina, in front of a picture of George Balanchine or Balanchine. Now, this is the mental industrial phase of Tantra. The mental structure of Tantra, however, need not always be expressed. The mental structure of Tantra, however, need not always be expressed in a sublimated form of mentor and muse, as the careers of such famous lovers slash muses like Frau Lu and Elmer Mahler indicate. Let us use the language of complex dynamical systems to suggest that there are certain, quote, basins of attraction, unquote, that exert a pull on couples into one form over another. Frau Lu, for example, might express one form of relationship with Nietzsche in her 20s, but quite another with Rilke in her 30s. And it was much the same with Alma Mahler, with Gustav Mahler, Gropius, Klimt, and Kokoschka. That's four creators. Mahler, Gropius, Klimt, K-L-I-M-T, and Kokoschka, K-O-K-O-S-C-H-K-A. The psychology of these sorts of creative slash erotic relationships, perhaps more characteristic of a romantic era than our own, would make for a wonderful series of films if American and European filmmakers were up to the task, which, judging by the recent film, quote, When Nietzsche Wept, film title, in which Fraulein Lou is presented as a blonde bimbo valley girl. They decidedly are not. So some modern movie redid, I guess, Nietzsche and Fraulein Lou. So he's saying it would be good if American and European filmmakers were up to the task to display this, but they decidedly are not, because a recent approximation was the film When Nietzsche Wept failed to present the woman properly. We Americans especially seem to suffer from an eternally adolescent understanding of sexuality in which we oscillate between the pornographic and the puritanical. Although we are immersed in an advertising umwelt, U-M-W-E-L-T, German word, of female breasts. Although we are immersed in an advertising umwelt of female breasts from the Huffington Post photo column on side boobs and nip slips, from the, you know what that is, Carolyn? Nip slip. From the Huffington Post photo column on side boobs and nip slips to the Mad Men TV show profiling of Christina Hendricks. A mother nursing in the park is considered obscene. See image on next page, and it shows a Venezuelan citizen talks to her president. What was the name of that guy? The guy who died recently. The one that threatened the West. Says a Venezuelan citizen talks to her president. Can we imagine this scene taking place in the United States and appearing in our media? So there's the president and a bunch of people standing around a woman while she's breastfeeding right in front of the president while they're discussing some political issues. So he says, although we are immersed in an advertising umwelt of female breasts, like in Huffington Post and in Mad Men TV show, a mother nursing in the park is considered obscene. See image on next page. That's in North America. It's considered obscene. To expect us to understand the psychological relationship between blocked desire and imaginative creativity is to look for the wisdom of old age in a sub-teen. Americans are sub-teens. Let me check the time here. Okay. The tantra, now he goes into the modern tantra of the title. Modern integral tantra yoga. The tantra of the integral structure of consciousness is only now emerging. Whether Sri Aurobindo and the mother, as an avataric couple, express the non-sexual level of the mental structure or the transformed carnal of the integral structure, only they would know. The integral tantra does require revisiting the physical and biological foundation of consciousness by lifting up, in Hegel's sense of how Haben, all the earlier stages. So the integral includes or replays the earlier stages. The integral does require revisiting the physical and biological foundation of consciousness by lifting up, in Hegel's sense of how Haben, all the early stages. It is not the repressed and sublimated form of the sexuality of the mental structure, and revisits elements of the magical, mythic, and mental structures within it, but turns on the spiral and takes them up to the next level in the Maithuna, M-A-I-T-H-U-N-A, of the higher subtle bodies beyond the physical, etheric, and astral levels of the historically earlier stages of spiritual development. The emphasis on the body fluids and magical tantra focuses on menstrual blood and semen. In mythical tantra, this emphasis is more refined or distilled, but is based on the exchange of erotic vaginal fluid and saliva in a ritual kissing and worship of the yoni, Y-O-N-I. In mental tantra, in the perspectival mentality that Gebser has explored, the beloved becomes a visual subject isolated in space, but still desired. That was in the industrial phase. Consequently, this tantra, the integral tantra, Consequently, the mental tantra becomes one of sublimation or transformation into the work of art. Dante's Beatrice in Heaven in the Paradiso. The body fluid for this tantra is the tear, with the eye as the appropriate locus for the perspectival mentality, I would add a visual space, and the shift from olfactory to visual cognition characteristic of humans. Generally, the great love stories from this period of culture are ones of frustration, separation, and sadness because the materialistic worldview is one of separate objects moving in space. It is not a mystical worldview of interpenetrating presences. Integral tantra revisits but does not repeat magical tantra with the sacred kiss in which the saliva and breath are lightly exchanged as the tongues touch. On the scientific side, the saliva contains pheromones, and these trigger oxytocin production and reduce the stress hormone of cortisol and can affect the neurotransmitters in the brain to create a feeling of joy and well-being. Rather than experiencing the tears of sadness of the dejected Rather than experiencing the tears of sadness of the dejected Renaissance lover with the mental tantra of frustration and sublimation, here the tears can be of joy. In integral tantra, there are tears of joy. Integral tantra also revisits but does not repeat magical tantra's etheric emphasis on the body fluids of semen and blood by focusing on the vital prana of the exchange of breath of the couple facing one another, seated in siddhasana, rather than the caudal yabhyam yogic posture. This shift from liquid to gas and the biospheric interpenetration of each partner with the other through pranayama expresses an emblematic and sacramental refinement of the magical into the integral and lays down a path of further coordination and integration of the higher subtle bodies of the tantric consorts. Such coordination can express itself in creative projects of artistic or cultural collaboration, or in the case of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, the creation of their ashram in Auroville in India. But even before the stage of yogic practice, in which the triad and integral tantra emerges, there must come the stage of the cultural liberation of women. The reactionary efforts to contain women in the Abrahamic religions can therefore be seen as evil. Evil is that which is out of timing. If Godzilla takes a walk in the Jurassic, there's no problem. But if he takes a walk in modern-day Tokyo, it is evil, and all hell breaks loose. For those committed to the past of the Abrahamic religions, the present emergence of women in our new prophetic emanation is evil. But as I have argued in my books, Like Imaginary Landscape, that's about 1989, quote, evil is the enunciation of the next level of organization, unquote. For those of us living in this emerging future that is already present for us, the liberation of women from the control of men in the Abrahamic religions is an expression of the prophetic spirit of the new enlightenment and integral yoga. The liberation of women from the control of men in the Abrahamic religions is an expression of the prophetic spirit of the new enlightenment, and integral tantra is one way for men and women to embody this spirit in the world. So I think we're coming to a close, but we know that the creation of Ayandam is an exercise of integral tantra between Bob and Connie and either JW or Ion. And so modern societies where men and women work together, they got to learn about this integral yoga, integral tantra. So maybe we'll talk a bit more after the break, and we'll maybe continue this next time, a little bit more details.